everybody. It is Wednesday, December 21st, 2011, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can drop us a line by emailing us at ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn about all the fun things happening with our little gay radio show. And, of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. So much ground to cover on this week's show, so we're going to start out with our first guest. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am.
All right, let me introduce you. Since 2001, Edith Klein has worked as the executive director of Keshet, a national grassroots organization whose mission is to ensure that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Jews are fully included in all parts of the Jewish community. In that time, she has built Keshet from a one-person local organization to a change-inspiring entity with an international reach. Under her leadership, Keshet mobilized over 30 Massachusetts congregations to help defeat the proposed anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment. Edith has also served as the executive producer of the documentary film Hineni, coming out in a Jewish high school. She's been an activist in the queer women's community in Israel and played a role in early organizing around the creation of the Jerusalem Open House. She was among 8 recipients of the 2003-2005 Joshua Venture Fellowship for Young Jewish Social Entrepreneurs. She's a past fellow and current board member of the Jewish Organizing Initiative and was honored by the Jewish Women's Archive with a Women Who Dared Award. And now she's here to speak with us. Edith Klein, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. And I was struck listening to your introduction. Have you ever said Jewish so many times in one introduction?
It's called my childhood, Edith. I would say we called that Tuesday. We called that Tuesday. That was just on the way to Hebrew school. I feel it came up that many times. Well, so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. How would you describe your path? I love talking to folks who are involved, so heavily involved in nonprofit work. And we get tons of emails from folks all over the country saying, I want to get involved in nonprofit work. How would you describe your path to your current position?
Well, in many ways, I would say my path started as a very young person. I was born in Israel and grew up in the States, but grew up with a strong sense of Israeli identity and with my sense of being Jewish as primarily about being a part of a people. So I grew up with this very strong sense of myself, you know, as a Jew, and that being about peoplehood and about culture in a secular Israeli family. At the same time, through a series of fluky circumstances, I was trying to escape a neighborhood bully. I ended up going to an Orthodox Jewish day school. So it was very interesting for me to be this secular Israeli kid in an Orthodox Jewish day school. And I completely fell in love with traditional Jewish text study. And I've often said that I was doing kind of far more sophisticated critical reading as a third grader in Orthodox day school than I would for years in my English classes. And what I loved about it and what I still love about Jewish text study, and this has a queer connection, it is that, the tradition of Jewish text study really mandates you to be an active participant. And I'll never forget the first day when I looked at a page of text from the Torah when I was 7 years old, whatever I was in third grade, and the rabbi kind of explained to me where the main text was, where the Torah or Bible text was, and then he pointed out the various commentators that we'd be looking at. And one commentator was someone from 11th century France named Rashi. Someone else was a commentator named Onkelos. You know, there were all these commentators that we'd be looking at who lived at different times, who had different opinions and often disagreed with one another. And my rabbi said to me, and you will sometimes disagree with them. We want to hear what you think too. So with that kind of very early sense of the Jewish intellectual and spiritual and cultural tradition being a tradition that was about and ongoing, that was really an ongoing conversation, an ongoing ever-evolving dialogue. I think that combined with, you know, this very primary sense I had of myself as a Jew being a member of a people meant that when I came out when I was in college, unlike a lot of other LGBTQ Jews whom I've met over the years, I didn't for a single millisecond doubt that I could be gloriously queer and Jewish at the same time. It just never occurred to me that there was a contradiction until many people started asking me how I felt about the contradiction.
Right. And then suddenly you had to say, oh, I didn't even know.
Exactly. I mean, obviously I got it, but, you know, but what I realized, but I think I didn't realize the extent to which, people would assume that anyone, that most people, the extent to which the assumption was, this is going to be a struggle for you before you can embrace it. So that was, you know, one big piece. And then the larger big piece, which I really should share because I think it's really the point of departure for my commitment to justice broadly, is that I'm the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors on both sides, and I learned about what my aunt described as the bad men who took her away and put the blue numbers in her arm when she was 18, when I was 4.5 years old. And,
wow.
That both terrified me and made me feel, and I very distinctly remember locking the front door of her house to keep the bad men out and then thinking to myself, I know they can get through this too, even though I've locked it, and then feeling like, wow, I've got to do whatever I can do to change the world so there won't be bad men. And I really think kind of that's where my sense of empathy and identification with, you know, other peoples who are oppressed and just my commitment to fighting injustice really started.
Now, you do come at this work, which I wish more people had this perspective, but you do come at this work with I hope it's a benefit, the benefit of an international perspective, that you have worked abroad and done social justice work abroad. How does that perspective enhance your work here?
I've never been asked that question. Yeah, so I mean, I'd say, you know, had various activist experiences as a kid, and as a gay activist, I started out in college, but my real world activism started in Jerusalem, where I lived for 3 years after I graduated from college, as you mentioned earlier. And I think one thing that being an activist in Israel specifically gave me was the experience of a kind of quick return on investment. Meaning that, things can move very slowly there, and things can also move very quickly because it's a small society in which, you know, here people say that, people often talk about 6 degrees of separation. Well, I think in Israel, certainly among Jewish Israelis, but there are also cross connections, you know, among Jews, Muslims, and Christians in Israel, but certainly among Jewish Israelis, it's probably like a 0.25 degree of separation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started out just running a support group for bi and lesbian women. This was kind of before the advent of kind of use of the word queer as popularly as it is today. And within a month, you know, we were getting 60 people a week coming to these meetings.
Wow.
A support group continued to be a support group, but also became a group that was really about creating change around LGB and a little of T issues in the broader society. And so I think that was really critical for me as a young activist to experience success, as opposed to experience a lot of setbacks and failure. I mean, I think I'm naturally an optimist, but that certainly bolstered my positive outlook and kind of my approach to this work as assuming that eventually people will get it.
And then 2001 rolls around.
Yes.
And you're looking around and saying, what am I going to do now? And you see an opening at Keshet.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's a little bit different. I moved back to the States in 1997, and Keshet had been founded as a grassroots group of LGBT Jews that was at that time primarily a group of gay Jewish men. It was founded by two gay Jewish men.
Okay.
And I started going to some of their meetings, and between 1997 and 2001, I became very involved as a volunteer leader. And I started bringing community organizing methodologies to our work at Keshet and started to really build Keshet as a grassroots organization. And in the summer of 2001, I had just finished grad school. I got a master's from UMass Amherst in social justice education, and was thinking about what I wanted to do. And Keshet was really at a point that I think a lot of volunteer-run grassroots organizations reach of leadership being just exhausted.
Right.
And the organization being at a point of either. It's going to continue to limp along and eventually probably disappear, you know, or people really need to step up and try to make something happen.
Right.
And so I actually had a different job, coordinating an environmental justice campaign at another nonprofit. But I decided to leave that job and try to make something happen with Keshet.
You had a vision.
I did.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. I want to talk about the phrase. I'm kind of fascinated by the phrase that I see in a lot of Keshet material, national grassroots. Because I think that on the show over the past few years, we've interviewed so many folks, and I feel like we've interviewed people on the national scene, and we've interviewed people on the grassroots scene. And so even I'm just struck by the phrase national grassroots and what that can mean for an organization.
Question number two, I've never been asked before.
Yeah, we're going to just keep this going.
So we started out as a local Boston organization. So our roots are as I said, we started out as a volunteer-run organization. So our roots are very much in the grassroots. We continue to define ourselves as a grassroots organization, as a national organization, because our focus in terms of how we do the work is really community by community, leader by leader, campaign by campaign. So we do produce resources that can be used for LGBT equality and inclusion in the Jewish community that we distribute nationally. And we do speak at conferences and do other sorts of work that are about kind of us putting something out there and people responding as more passive consumers.
Right.
But the bulk of our work is work in which we look to people in communities to be actors.
Okay.
So for example, one of our primary ways of creating change in the Jewish community is by training Jewish community leaders, often educators, but not exclusively, training them to train their peers and colleagues, training them to facilitate community dialogues, to facilitate programs about LGBT issues within their own communities. So we'll bring together directors of education at Hebrew schools, rabbis, youth group advisors, directors of summer camps for a three-day intensive training in which we'll train them in kind of the LGBT content from a Jewish perspective, some community organizing methods about, how do you actually make something happen in your institution or in your community once you go home? And the theory behind it, and on the whole, the theory has borne out to be successful, the theory behind it is that by training people to take on leadership on these issues in their own communities, we're building capacity that stays in that community, as opposed to an outside organization kind of helicoptering in, facilitating a great program that may make people feel really inspired and excited, but then 1 month later, do they really remember what they wanted to do, and can they implement it? Generally not, unfortunately. So that's a big piece of why we continue to define ourselves as a national grassroots organization.
And one of the activities that you offered is this building capacity for GLBT Jewish activism. And I don't want to circumvent people actually going to the workshop, so I'm going to pick on one little part of this. In that type of work, what types of qualities do you all talk about in that can sustain change? We talk a lot here about how do you keep from burning out. And so what types of qualities, apart from the very specific work that people have to do, what types of qualities do you all like to inspire to build that change that is sustained?
We do a lot of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
We actually close every staff meeting with what we call story time, just within our staff of people in Boston, San Francisco, and Denver. You're not allowed to tell a sad story in story time.
Well, there you go.
Story time is a time for telling stories about change happening, and so that's a piece. I always emphasize when I speak with either grassroots leaders or professional LGBT or ally Jews, the need to pause and celebrate and to note success,
right?
And to do so collectively. When people on a personal level, if people ask me for kind of advice on how I keep myself from getting burnt out, for me, Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, has played probably the largest role in my life of anything from keeping me from getting burnt out, because particularly when you're an executive director, but I think often in any kind of nonprofit or, yeah. or activist work, it can become 24/7 work. And, you know, and it's something that is your life's work. And so it makes sense that it's 24. It makes sense that it could be that. And
right.
It's so fully integrated into your life. You know, and certainly when I started running Keshet, I was running Keshet out of a room in my house and, you know, reached the point pretty quickly that there were regularly Keshet materials and often volunteers in every room in my house besides the bathroom, and occasionally people were there as well. So, I don't think there's Keshet materials in, though. But so I, since my junior year of college, have not worked on Shabbat. And that's meant different things at different times. When I was in college and grad school, that meant that I didn't do, you know, I didn't do reading or for classes, and I didn't write papers on Shabbat.
Right.
Now what it means is that I don't do Keshet work on Shabbat. And having that, you know, those 25 hours when I've taken off my watch, I always take off my watch at the beginning of Shabbat, and having that period of time when, you know, people who know me know they're not going to hear back from me, and people who don't know find out later on if they're annoyed that they haven't heard back from me. And that's also, I feel like, a really good reality check in terms of maintaining humility, which I also think is a big piece of keeping yourself from getting burnt out. You know, I mean, I've had people I've interacted with before, you know, largely donors or others who kind of expect, you know, absolutely immediate response. You know, I've had people respond with annoyance at times when I've shared that I don't work on Shabbat. You know, and my, you know, response, you know, always internally, and sometimes I share this, is that, you know, yes, the work that we do is critical, and in the big picture, the work that I do believe that the work we do is about saving lives, but on a day-to-day basis,
right,
you know, we are not a suicide hotline,
right,
and I'm not a heart surgeon, and so the work I do is critical, but it's okay for me to be unavailable for 25 hours and nothing will happen. You know, the world will go on, and I think that's, you know, I mean, I think you know, there are a lot of contradictions that one, back to contradictions, there are a lot of contradictions that, you know, that I do hold doing this work. Like, on the one hand, like, things are okay. I do feel like things are okay, you know, and I can shut off for 24 hours. And things are so not okay, and there's so much work that needs to be done. And so I think it's holding, you know, those two contradictory realities is both true, which I feel is both sustaining and driving.
I totally want to start doing story time at my staff meetings.
Great.
I'll credit you all. Well, let's talk about more projects from Keshet, could this be closer to the heart of our show, the Hineni Education Project.
Yes.
How is that going? And, of course, tell people about it.
The Hineni Education Project started with a film, a one-hour documentary film called Hineni Coming Out in a Jewish High School. And the word Hineni is a Hebrew word that means here I am. And it appears many times in the Torah.
Yes.
And when it appears, it always appears in a context in which someone is called upon to take action, to step up and take leadership. And the story that's told is a story about one person who then inspired many people to step up and take action. It tells the story of a high school girl who entered her Jewish high school as the only out person in that school. And the school that she went to was a Jewish community high school, so that means there were kids from completely secular to quite Orthodox and everything in between. And the faculty also reflected that spectrum. So she entered her high school as the only out person in the school, felt really isolated, and meanwhile was living in Lexington, Massachusetts, where she knew that Lexington High School had one of the largest, most vibrant GSAs in the state of Massachusetts, and she felt like, why shouldn't I have that, even though I'm at a Jewish school?
Right.
So with some support from us that started with an internship she had the summer after her sophomore year of high school, she started a campaign at her high school to establish what ended up becoming the first gay-straight alliance at a Jewish high school in the country.
Wow.
And during the course of her campaign, in addition to several students who came out and several students and many more students who stepped up and publicly identified as straight allies, four teachers out of a faculty of I think 26 or 28 came out, including the head of the Bible department. And so it really had a transformative impact on the school, which,
wow,
you know, which they still talk about to this day. So when we produced Hineni, we were out of my house by then. We had an office, but staff-wise, it was just me and a part-time administrative person. And we produced it intending for it to be used as an educational tool, and we believed that it could be used as a tool to inspire change in the Jewish community, but we really didn't have the infrastructure to create a plan to implement that. And yet we quickly jumped into gear creating one because, oh, that's funny. The director of Hineni literally just now called me on my cell phone.
See, we're putting out the karma and it's coming right back.
It is. I want to share her name. The director of Hineni is an amazing woman who works at WGBH as her day job. Her name is Irina Feingold.
Nice.
And she really produced Hineni as a labor of love over the course of 3.5 years.
Wow.
And so what happened on the Keshet end is that Hineni premiered to a sold-out audience at the Museum of Fine Arts in November of 2005, and we immediately started getting bombarded with requests for film screenings from all over the country and soon from all over the world. And along with requests for film screenings came requests for trainings and speakers and consultations because not everyone, but most of the people asking for screenings realized, oh, if I'm going to screen this film about kids, Jewish kids coming out and about the issues that come up specifically in a Jewish context to my bar and bat mitzvah kids or to adult members of my community, and we've never talked about LGBT issues, I need some help in figuring out how to facilitate that conversation.
The Q&A needs some work.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, and many of these people hoped that the Q&A would be more than just kind of a static Q&A that would stay within the room, but rather it would be a conversation that would lead to, that would lead to ongoing action and change.
Yeah.
And so we started developing training modules, and out of that grew the Train the Trainer Institutes, which I spoke about earlier, and out of that grew the production of materials for LGBT inclusion beyond the film, because people started saying to us, the film is great, but what do we do when, you know, the only visual materials that we have available, are about Jewish holidays, you know, only show straight couples.
Right.
And Hebrew workbooks, all talk about, mother, father.
Right.
And so we started producing some of those materials and really approaching the concept of creating full equality and inclusion in Jewish life as about integration. So that means not seeking for people to teach one class a year on LGBT issues in the social justice course, but rather for when you're teaching about marriage, in Jewish tradition, talk about innovations in the marriage ceremony that have come about as a result of egalitarianism in Judaism and as a result of LGBT inclusion in Judaism.
Right, right. Oh, that's such good work. That's such good work.
Thank you so much.
Now, we'll do a quick shout out. Is the Keshet Quick Dates program still happening?
So the Keshet Quick Dates is not still happening. It could be revived. So the Keshet Quick Dates, kind of branded as Quick Dates, isn't happening, but we do hold singles events.
Okay.
So what Ken is referring to actually was our first ever program, which was a queer Jewish speed dating Christmas Eve event.
Wow.
Which we held for the first time in December of 2001.
I'm showing up this year. I don't care who else comes. I'm there.
So after about 6 years, I mean, the Boston kind of queer Jewish community is small enough that, unfortunately, there were people who kind of kept showing up year after year, and it became kind of depressing. So we got some feedback that, we should just change things up a bit. So now we've held singles events, some of which are speed dating and some of which are less formalized, for that focus on different populations. So we've had speed dating for gay men, all gender speed dating, et cetera. So I'm glad to put you on our event to list, Ken.
I want the executive director's personal attention on working out this particular issue in the LGBT community.
Well, anyone I like, I'm always thinking of them. So you're definitely on that list.
That's awesome. Now, 'tis the season for Hanukkah, as you perhaps know, and I want to talk real quick about your piece in Global Voices, the blog of American Jewish World Service. A fantastic piece, and I would like to quote from it real quick. You wrote, quote, "I believe that the candles convey our choice to be visibly Jewish in a world where it is all too easy to hide. I see the purpose and power of this act as twofold, affirming and enriching those who choose to claim Jewish identity in the public eye, while challenging onlookers to celebrate difference, not dismantle it. Much like this choice we face on Hanukkah, I've always felt that choosing to come out as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender is a profoundly Jewish act, making a public claim to identity, asserting an affiliation, daring to declare difference." Well, heck, that was well written.
Thank you.
What kind of feedback have you gotten on that piece?
I've gotten really great feedback, actually. And it's funny because when I first got the invitation to write it, I felt like, oh, I don't really have anything to say about Hanukkah. It's not such an interesting holiday.
Right.
And I really should thank my partner Jordan for encouraging me to write the piece. She really pushed me to do it. So this is thanks to her.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you, Jordan. So when I sat down and started thinking about it, I realized, actually I do have something to say about it, and there are some real parallels between, the work that I do in the world, and some of the meanings of this holiday. So I've gotten great feedback just, from, lots of folks who are Keshet members, from some donors, and from people who have learned about us, through seeing that piece on American Jewish World Service's website.
Okay, everybody has to go check out that piece. Great piece. Now, we do have to talk about your musical selections for this week's episode.
Yes.
This is the part of the show, Edith, where you tell our listening audience what some of your song selections say about you.
Yes.
This is a little bit of self-analysis.
Yes.
And we are going to talk about Jordan in a second, because that's going to come up, but we'll save that. Now, you had a very distinctive category of music for this week's show, which as I wrote to you separately, I quite enjoyed because I didn't have to download anything. Everything was already there on my iPod. So it was a very glee-tastic week for This Show Is So Gay. So we're going to talk about some of your Glee song selections. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to tell us what these songs say about you. We'll choose a couple of them. What does, let's give this some complexity too, because it's not just the song, but also the Glee version. What does the Glee version of "Don't Stop Believin'" say about Edith Cline?
It says that, for me, I think it reflects, a real persistent, unflagging optimism.
Nice.
And sense of hope that I have, which is something that I have brought to my work in Keshet. It's something that I brought to, my first job out of college, which was working at a cooperative Israeli-Palestinian peace organization, and that I continue to marshal in relation to prospects for Israeli-Palestinian peace. Really this faith that no matter how terrible things seem, things can turn around. And the Glee version in particular, I love that show. I love those kids. I talk about them like they're people in my life. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this on the air.
That's okay.
But I feel like they capture so many salient issues in society, and so many issues that are core to the experience, to the challenging experience of being youth in our society, and do so with complexity and sophistication and nuance and wonderful humor. Every week there are moments while I'm watching this show that I turn to my partner and say, my God, this must be so great for some kid out there to be watching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let me make you do one more. How about the Glee, or you wrote the Wicked version, what does Defying Gravity say about Edith Cline? There's a running theme here.
A little bit, yeah. So Defying Gravity says that I kind of operate in the world as if, and people have said this about me, sometimes as a criticism and sometimes as a compliment, I kind of operate in the world with the faith that something that initially seems impossible can be possible. And that is something that I use in my work, in my relationships, in my dreams and whatever I'm striving for, in my encouragement of, friends and other loved ones in my life. And so both the words to define gravity and the, incredible vocal range that's demanded by the song and just the ferocity of the song, I mean, all of that for me reflects the kind of just, deep, deep, ferocious will that, we all need to have in the world if we believe that we can create meaningful, serious change.
Nice. Nice. Now, I am saying, and I'm a man of my word, I will not out neither you nor Jordan with my next question. I am a man of my word. I'm just putting the question out there. Were there any songs that you perhaps proposed that Jordan shot down?
Well,
that perhaps Jordan put on Facebook.
So everyone is invited, if you're a good detective, to find my partner on Facebook. But I'm going to, she's a communications professional, so I'm going to defer to her veto and not publicly say the first song that leapt to mind. Except to share that it is also a Glee song, which I think sends a very important message.
This is such a tantalizing morsel of that people can just go out there and do some discovery. Now, I should also tell you, and this is very exciting, probably more for me than for you, but you are the first guest out of, 200 some odd guests over the past 3 years, the first guest requested by my sister Melissa.
Really?
Because what did she see in the newspaper about you and Jordan not that long ago? She saw your wedding announcement and she sent me an email immediately and said, you have to have her on your show. And you are the first guest to be requested by my sister. And it was actually a really nice moment. My dad, my dad is endless with guest suggestions, but first one from my sister. And so it was just you provided a really nice bonding moment. Oh, it was lovely.
Oh, I'm so glad.
It was quite lovely.
Well, thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa. Look at that. I do want to say, because this was kind of an exciting moment. We were recording a show in Greenfield the night that the Transgender Equal Rights Bill passed mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, and we were at a Trans Day of Remembrance youth candlelit vigil. It was quite incredible. Where were you when the Trans Equal Rights Bill passed?
So I was actually in Israel when the Trans Equal Rights Bill passed. I was in Israel with a group of 20 other queer Jews on a trip that Keshet led together with two other LGBT Jewish organizations, Nehirim and A Wider Bridge. And there were a couple gender, there was one trans person and one genderqueer person on our trip, and there were people from Boston. There were people from all over the country on the trip, but there were some people from Boston and other parts of Massachusetts who had worked hard on the bill, and we at Keshet definitely worked for years to help advance the legislation. So it was this funny experience of feeling like we were so far away from where things were happening, but also, in a community in which we could really celebrate together.
Nice. I love that. I read that on the Huffington Post. What a lovely story. That was fantastic. Now, where can folks go to learn all about the cool things that you guys are doing?
So they can go to our website, which is www.keshetonline.org. That's K-E-S-H-E-T online.org, all one word. Or for people who want to hear a human voice, you can pick up the phone and call our Boston office at 617-524-9227. And the phone numbers for our Denver and Bay Area offices, which probably fewer people out there are going to hear the show, but those phone numbers are on our website.
Fantastic. Well, look, I just thoroughly enjoy talking to anyone who is working at any type of intersection, and this is one that's going to hit close to home for me just as a gay Jew, but I'm so inspired by Keshet, by the work that you do, and I hope that you never tire of hearing just how incredible it is to have you all working to provide more of a voice for a community that's always looking to have a voice, that's always looking to create some change, a community that social justice is so at the heart of who we are as a people. And your work is just invaluable in those efforts. And so really, on behalf of the community, thank you so much for everything that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and thank you for the enthusiasm. That's definitely a big piece of what keeps us going.
You're going to keep doing what you're doing?
I will.
All right. Adit Klein, an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. You too, Kevin.
All the best.
You too. Just a snuck down girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere. A singer in a smoky room, the smell of them cheap perfume, for a smile. All right, folks, and we are back. So, in November, we were reading off the names of all the fun gay folks who got elected, and we stumbled a little bit when we reported that Alex Morse was elected to office in Holyoke because the story did not say to what office, and we didn't have that information at the time of the taping. Then a huge bunch of listeners wrote in and said, mayor, he was elected mayor, so we corrected that on the following show, but we were still feeling really bad, so we decided to drive on down to Holyoke and apologize in person. Let me introduce him. Mayor-elect Alex Morse was born and raised in Holyoke and is a proud product of the city's public schools. He then went on to complete a degree in urban studies from Brown University. He is the founder of Holyoke for All, the city's first LGBT nonprofit organization, and for 3 years he sat on the Massachusetts governor's LGBT commission, and oh yeah, he got elected to a mayoral status a few weeks back. Mayor-elect Alex Morse, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing really well. We have so much to talk about. Are you ready? From my notes, it says that first political office for you was when you were 11 years old.
Well, I was around 11 or 12 when I first joined the Holyoke Youth Commission, which was a group of young people here in Holyoke that met with the mayor once a month and came together to talk about issues in the city. So that was my first introduction to civics and government.
And what appealed to you about that?
I just like the fact that I could join people my age and actually make a difference and make things happen in the community. We started a basketball league for young people. We started a kids vote program to help to allow people younger than 18 to vote in mayoral and presidential elections. So it appealed to me that I could meet with the mayor on a regular basis and have a voice in my community at a very young age.
And then you decided to step it up a bit at 15 and run for freshman class president. Is that right?
I did. I ran for class president my freshman year. I beat a popular cheerleader, which is very satisfying.
I was going to ask you, do you remember who you beat? But I guess you do.
I do, yes.
Do we still talk to her? Are we Facebook friends with her?
Her family voted for me, so we're happy about
that. Look at that. It's come full circle. It's come full circle. And then you did some research, too, when you were working on various commissions, and you went. We've actually talked about the Harlem Children's Zone on the show before. Tell us about that experience of visiting there.
In October 2009, I took a trip to Harlem with a delegation of 10 folks from Springfield and 10 of us from Holyoke. I was lucky enough to be one of those 10. And we spent, I think, about 4 days in New York looking at the Harlem Children's Zone, meeting with Jeffrey Canada, to explore what areas of the Harlem Children's Zone we could potentially replicate in the city of Holyoke, because we have a daunting challenge as an education, a high dropout rate, low literacy rate. So it's really important that to make Holyoke a better place, we have to make some basic investments in education.
All right. And now it brings us – that was a quick recap. We're now in the present. It brings us to – you're going to decide to run for mayor, which I understand you decided while you were still a student at Brown.
Yes. I've been thinking about running for a couple of years. I started getting serious about it summer after junior year of college. I was studying in the Dominican Republic January through May 2010. I got back May 8th, 2010, and then May 9th I was meeting with folks, base building, meeting with people, saying this is what I'm thinking about doing. That was in May 2010. September 2010 is when I started raising money, calling people and letting them know that I had officially decided that this was in fact what I was doing. And January of this year, around 11, 12 months ago, is when I went on the steps of City Hall with family, friends, close supporters, and announced my intention to run for mayor of the city of Holyoke.
Now, I mean, I'm a dean of students at a college. Had one of my seniors come to me and said, listen, I'm going to run for mayor, I know I'm not yet done, I'm not going to lie, I might have said, you need to finish.
Yeah.
Were there any people like me who said, no, you need to finish first?
Of course. There's always going to be naysayers, even in the mayor's office.
Okay, wait, I'm not saying that I'm a naysayer. I'm just saying, as a dean of students, I would have been concerned.
Well, I think a lot of times we internalize values around age, and I think ageism is something we don't really talk about in terms of the abilities of young people and what we think their potential, they're able to do in life. My age never fazed me. That I was still in school never fazed me. I've been really cognizant of staying involved in the city of Holyoke, even while at Brown. I commuted back and forth on a regular basis.
Wow.
Still worked in Holyoke at a career center as a youth career counselor, stayed involved in organizations with the Harlem Children's Zone here in Holyoke, because I knew I wanted to continue and dedicate my life to the city. So while my classmates at Brown were fleeing their hometowns to study
right.
abroad and do internships and overseas, I always wanted to come back and return to my hometown, to my family, to my community. That's where I felt I made the most difference. So that was really, really important to me. I was a junior, 21, at the time I decided to run. And then a senior, my whole senior year at Brown, I was pretty much full-time campaigning, door knocking, having fundraisers, house parties. And it didn't, we had to overcome the age question, obviously. But we did it, and I worked the hardest, and I beat three other folks who've been established figures in Holyoke politics for decades, and that's something we're really proud of.
Because to be clear, my students would have my hide if there were any allegations that I'm ageist. I just want to make sure you finish your degree. That's what I'm worried about.
I did finish my degree.
You did finish your degree, and you went to commencement?
I'm a multitasker.
Okay.
I did go to commencement, and I was the guest speaker in the Urban Studies department ceremony.
Great. That's great. And where were you this week? You did some traveling this week.
Yeah, where was I? I just got back late last night. I was in D.C. for the past few days. I was invited to the White House holiday party.
How was it?
By Obama and Michelle. It was great. It was a fantastic opportunity for me to represent the people in the city of Holyoke, to have a brief conversation with the president about the city, and it was just an incredible opportunity. Never before had I been to the White House, and the holidays are the best time of year to go. It was absolutely gorgeous and exhilarating to walk the halls of that beautiful building.
That's fantastic. Now, I want to talk real quick about your decision to seek an endorsement from the Victory Fund,
mm-hmm.
because we talk about this a lot on the show. It's something that I myself went through and I struggled with enormously and got a lot of flack for in my community, that, hey, this is not this is not what your campaign is about. This, your campaign is about the issues. Why seek this endorsement? I have my own reasons. Yeah. I would love to hear yours.
So why I sought the endorsement of the Victory Fund. I think any, as a candidate, you have to decide what you're willing to do to win. I've been out to my constituents and the general public here in Holyoke for the past 6 years. I came out when I was 16. Came out to the entire student body, organized a first ever teacher training on LGBT issues. It was no secret that I'm openly gay, so I didn't have to overcome that stigma of having to come out throughout the election, which is very helpful. It's anything that people want to use against you in a campaign, if you claim it and are honest about it, it's less of an issue. So I've always been honest about my sexuality, and I had to overcome questions of my age more so than my sexuality. But in terms of the Victory Fund endorsement, I went to D.C. in December of last year for the openly gay candidates training, how to balance being openly gay and being a candidate for public office. Obviously, my platform isn't specific to LGBT issues and, and a specific gay agenda, but I think it informs the kind of leader that I am, and I had to learn the skill of sort of pivoting questions about my sexuality back to issues of education, public safety, economic development, and civic pride, the issues that I campaigned on. You know, Victory Fund did donate a small amount to my campaign, and I think they're supporting LGBT candidates across the country, and I'm proud to be among those people, but I don't think it's an issue. And my opponent and folks on the opposition tried to make it a point that I was receiving outside money, but at the end of the day, you know, voters don't fall for that fear-mongering, and I think it's about the values and the issues. And I spent the entire campaign talking about making our schools the best that they can be, making sure every resident had access to good jobs and safe neighborhoods. And that's the message that I talked about. And the fact that I was endorsed by the Victory Fund and got our city, once again, national attention is a testament to my leadership ability.
Now, the interesting thing for me was that I got more flack from local gay citizens about the endorsement than I did from their straight peers that, hey, we don't, this is not where you should be putting attention. But I absolutely agree. This is just another mechanism to build support.
It's a mechanism to build support. At the conference and the training, I was able to network with LGBT folks around the country, not only in government, but in the business community, community organizing groups. It's an incredible opportunity to network among other folks who are doing similar things across the country. People will always have complaints about the type of campaign you run, but if you stay focused and you execute your own campaign plan, which we did, You'll cross the finish line on election day, and it's easy to fall victim to the people who are complaining and telling you how to run a campaign. But if you believe in yourself, surround yourself with really great campaign operatives, you know, you'll sail away from there.
Well, let's talk about some of these issues, because this is the part of the show, Alex, where I blatantly steal some ideas of things that you're going to do in Holyoke, and I bring them to Vermont. So let's talk about some of the things that you said you will focus on. Tell us about the Arts and Entertainment District, what you would like to do down here in Holyoke.
Yeah, so Holyoke's on the cusp of doing really great things downtown. We have some exciting projects on the pipeline. The Green High Performance Computing Center is one of them. So the governor chose Holyoke as a site of a new computing center. So Harvard, MIT, Northeastern are investing around $170 million to build a computing center. That'll be complete October 2012. So my job now is to take advantage of that project, bring other companies, high-tech innovation companies, to the downtown. And at the same time, we'll be kicking off a campaign to restore the Victory Theater down on Suffolk Street in downtown Holyoke. And that theater, 40 years ago, was bustling every single night of the week, but has been abandoned and boarded up for the past 40 years. So it's my priority to make sure we open up that theater and bring people back downtown. So it's important to me that we have an art and entertainment district, and within that district we have live workspace for artists and provide incentives for art-related enterprises to come and move to that specific area of the city.
Well, let's do one more, because this one fascinates me, because my least favorite time of year is budgeting, and that's what we're doing right now. Tell us about participatory budgeting.
Yeah, so I have attended a few events throughout the campaign to learn about participatory budgeting, which has been sort of spreading quickly throughout the globe, and I think it's an innovative strategy to engage the general public in the budgeting process. So oftentimes, as elected officials, we talk about, you know, using public money and taxpayer money, but oftentimes we shut them out from the process of where we should be allocating funds. So participatory budgeting, in America, the best model is to look at, I think it's the 17th Ward in Chicago, and I forget the name of the counselor's name, but I went to his presentation in Springfield a couple months ago. And it's a process where it's sort of a separate election. You pinpoint maybe 1% or 2% of the budget, and you give it to the general public, and you come to a public forum and you vote, do you want to use $10,000 to build a new park downtown? Do you want to use the $10,000 to paint a mural on the side of a public building? Do you want to use the $10,000 to, do X, Y, or Z? And it's an opportunity for folks to come together from all backgrounds and decide how to spend $100,000 or $200,000 in their neighborhood so that people feel as if they have a role in deciding where money is being spent, because I think oftentimes we forget to engage citizens in the most essential decisions that we make. So I've made a commitment to any decision that I make about public money, I want to be transparent. I also want to put the city's checkbook online so, you know, taxpayers can log online and see where we are spending our money. And this is just another way to do that.
Transparency is a good thing. When is Inauguration Day?
Inauguration Day is on Tuesday, January 3rd.
How are you feeling about that?
Feeling good. We're in the process of, you know, we have a lot of great volunteers who are putting that event together.
There are going to be bagpipes. I just learned this.
They're
going to be bagpipes. I'm breaking this news to you. You will have bagpipes your inauguration.
That's wonderful. It's going to be a wonderful event. That's going to be a great event. But the other event to be at is the inaugural ball, which is on Saturday, January 14th.
And where is that at?
That's at the Log Cabin here in Holyoke.
That's pretty exciting. Yeah. Who's playing? Do we know?
We'll have some live music, a live piano player, some special guests. Sit-down dinner, formal attire. It's going to be the event to be at this year in Holyoke.
Look at that. That's awesome. So, look, we get emails particularly from youth all over the country who are saying, I have no voice, I have no voice. I want to create change, but I have no voice. Mayor-elect, what do you... I mean, I think we could just say mayor-elect, and that's enough to tell them that they do. But what do you have to say to all those youth?
Yeah, I think it's really important that, you know, people, first of all, believe in themselves. And it's incredibly important that you surround yourself with supportive people who believe in your dreams and aspirations. And if you don't, that's going to be a problem. So surround yourself with mentors, good adults who have your back, and friends that make you feel good about yourself. But don't let anyone ever tell you what you can and cannot do. At the beginning of this campaign, I wouldn't be here today if I listened to the folks who said, you know, wait your turn, run for city council, run for school committee, stay in school, go to grad school. You don't have a shot in hell. And I've heard that many, many times. But 12 months later, I'm on the verge of being sworn in as the mayor of Holyoke. So never let anybody tell you what you can and cannot do. Because one of the most satisfying things to do in life is to do what others tell you cannot do. So that's what I urge each and every one of you to do.
And for folks that are listening from all around the world who are saying, well, should I go to Holyoke on my next vacation? What do you have to say to them?
Of course. Holyoke is a great city. We have a great history. We're the first planned industrial city in the entire country, the first city to make paper. We're nicknamed the Paper City, the birthplace of volleyball. We have the second biggest St. Patrick's Day parade in the entire country. We have something for everybody, so we're a great place to...
I didn't know any of these things. Yeah, none of the things that you just said did I know, and I live only a few miles away.
Well, now you know. It's a great place. We're on the move, and it's the perfect time to move here, to invest here. We have some of the cheapest energy rates in the entire region of New England. So if you're looking to move a business to a city here in New England, you should definitely consider the city of Holyoke, and I'd be happy to personally invite you to lunch to make that conversation happen.
You're feeling okay about Holyoke's future?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. So where can folks go to learn more about all the cool things that you're doing?
Well, they can either go to transitionholyoke.com, or they could Facebook Alex Morse, which will soon be Mayor Alex Morse.
Are you looking forward to dropping that elect? Because it's kind of a fun title.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to dropping the elect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mayor elect for now, but soon to be Mayor Alex Morris. A real pleasure having you on
the show.
Thank
you for having me.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Elphaba, why couldn't you have stayed calm for once instead of flying off the handle? I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy now. I hope you're happy how you hurt your paws forever. I hope you think you're clever. I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy too. I hope you're proud how you would grovel in submission to feed your own ambition. Although I can't imagine how, I hope you're happy right now. Elfie, listen to me. Just say you're sorry. You can still be with the wizard, what you've worked and waited for. You can have all you ever wanted.
I know,
but I don't want it.
No,
I can't want it anymore. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by.
All right, that about wraps things up for this week's episode of This Show Is So Gay. As always, send us an email. Send it on over to Ken at thisshowisogay.com,
Always looking for guest ideas. If you have an idea for an LGBT or ally guest, send it on over to us and we will book them, we promise. And by that I mean, we will try to book them. Also, hop on over to thisshowsogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with the show. And go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, and you know what to do. Click like. Get out there, folks. Go do whatever it is that you do to make this world a better place and create some change. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts. Close my eyes and leap. It's time to try to find. You can't pull me down.
Can't I make you understand? You're having delusions of grandeur.
I am through accepting limits, 'cause someone says they're so. Some things I cannot change, but till I try I'll never know. Too long I've been afraid of losing love, I guess I've lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high. I did my mind to find gravity. Kiss me goodbye. I'm defying gravity. And you can't pull me down.
Glenda, come with me. Think of what we could do together.
I'm limited. Together we're unlimited. Together we'll be the greatest team there's ever been. Glenda, dreams the way we plan them. If we work in tandem, there's no fight we cannot win. Down. Well, are you coming?
I hope you're happy now that you're choosing this.
You too.
I hope it brings you bliss.
I really hope you get it and you don't live to regret it. I hope you're happy.
That there is or was is ever gonna bring.